Hello, and welcome. My name is Professor Richard Cunning. I run the English and Creative Writing programs with my wonderful team here at the University of Northampton. It's great that so many of you can make it. I'm just going to say a couple of sentences about the rationale behind the Memorial Lecture series. This is the first of the John Clare Memorial Lectures, taking place in a very important anniversary year, but you'll hear more about the anniversary year, I think, from others. And it coincided, the anniversary year for John Clare, with my sense, having been here just 2.5 years, of a number of sort of shared interests amongst the academics in my team, and also more broadly in the area, in the city, also at Althorpe, where we take part in the Literary Festival, where Earl Spencer has a marked interest in John Clare, and unfortunately can't be here today. But we didn't want the memorial, the anniversary year, to go past without taking the opportunity to try to establish a link with John Clare in a form, actually, which was a sabotaged form. The city council, I think, are we allowed to say this? Had plans for a bold, brassy statue of John Clare, but they didn't then have any money to make it happen. So, okay, you know all about it. So we had a bit of fun about that. And Charles and I really cooked up this alternative plan, which we felt was much more in keeping, really, with what was in the interests of English and creative writing academics and students, and very much better represented in a way, the way that we would like to engage with John Clare, which is by way of his words, by way of his poetry. So this is to be an annual event. We're going to invite a range of speakers year on year between English and creative writing. I think I can't quite announce who next year's is because we're just at the last stages of confirming, but it will be a Booker Prize shortlisted novelist. We're just waiting for it to be signed off. Watch this space anyway. You can always write to us if you don't get to hear, but we'll be announcing it soon. And that'll be this time in 12 months. But this year, Charles and I were thrilled to make an immediate approach to Professor Nick Groom from the University of Exeter on the basis of a book that attracted so much attention this past year, called The Seasons and About the Seasons, but now I'm stealing your lines, aren't I? Sorry, I was really only going to say welcome, thank you for coming, and to wish you all the best. And also to mention, I think that there are two handouts, the one which you'll need during the next hour or so, and the other which is just a little bit of feedback. And we really like everybody who isn't a student with us. It's not because we don't value your opinions, but you're not allowed to count. We'd like some, what they call, impact. This is a professional term which preoccupies many of us in academia. But it's just an opportunity to respond, and we can react by changing things, improving things, enhancing, doing more things. We're planning on plenty of outreach events for Northampton and the county and the local community in the near future. And so this is just an illustration of what we'd like to be doing. But the John Clare Memorial Lecture on themes relating to literature and the environment will be an annual one and will probably take place this time next year, give or take a day or two, so more to be announced. Anyway, I'll hand over to my colleague, Associate Professor Charles Bennett, otherwise known as the Poetry Tutor and so much more, also the Romanticism Tutor, so that's another vital link to what's about to happen, who's going to introduce Nick further. And thanks so much.
So, hello, it's nice to see you. Thank you for coming. Nice to see people I know, nice to see people I don't know so well. Hope you enjoy the event. I'm just going to say two things, really. I'm going to do, first of all, that thing you expect me to do, which is to say something about Nick. And then I'm just going to say something about John Clare, too, and then I'm going to shut up. So, Nick, Professor Nick Groom, co-director of the Centre for Literatures of Identity, Place and Sustainability at Exeter University, has recently written a very interesting book called The Seasons, an elegy that I thought your subtitle was really interesting, actually, but that's a whole other story. And, you know, there's lots of very good things and interesting things he's done. You know, why did we invite Nick, you know? He's got a fabulous CD. He's a really interesting person. An interesting person with interesting ideas. And more crucially, perhaps, although we can, you know, we can often read from the back of someone's book where we're introducing, it kind of brings me on to Claire. I think we fall in love first and then we think about it. So, I think we fall in love with John Clare first. I think we have an emotional relationship with our reading somehow, and with the poets that we fall in love with. We have that first. Then we think, this is interesting. I love this. I'd love to know more. I love this. I'd love to know more. It's just simple curiosity. And simple curiosity and fascination with the creativity makes us stimulated and makes us more alive. And therefore, contact with the creative arts is vital for our survival as a species, actually. So let me pass on to Nick, who is, as it were, someone who's in love with Claire and lots of other writers as well, who I rather like, but is also a thinker. And those two aspects, as it were, the head and the heart, will come together. Please join with me in welcoming Nick Richard.
Well, thanks very much, Charles and Richard, for those lovely introductions, and thanks for the invitation to be here, and thank you to all of you for making the effort. I'm particularly pleased to be here in Northampton because I was born in Northampton General Hospital, just a mile or so from here. And in fact, my doctoral research was on a writer who spent much of his life in the county, Thomas Percy, edited Percy's Relics, the first English ballad collection. And I think it's so important that the towns and cities and regions of the United Kingdom think carefully about cultural heritage and celebrate their local writers. And that's really what this paper is about. It's about how to celebrate this heritage. But how can the study of literature, history and folklore be part of the current ecological debate? Well, in my recent book, Seasons, I suggested a cultural analysis of the cycle of the year can reveal how experiences such as the weather are represented in England, how these representations have structured the understanding of the environment in the past, and how they continue to do so today. The upshot of this argument is to propose that the contemporary analysis of climate change should not be confined to bioscientists and meteorologists. It's also a cultural issue. And I do believe that it's only through developing such research that the discipline of English literature can justify its existence at university level in the current climate of environmental crisis. We need to take literature out of the classroom and get it working in the fields and woods and rivers that sustain us. If so, we could make literature and literary criticism a way of ensuring a fuller and crucially an active engagement with the world, rather than a means of escaping from it. What we need to develop, in other words, is a cultural environmentalism. Now, in England, the whole cycle of the seasons and consequently the comprehension of the weather and the flora and fauna developed as much as a series of cultural events as it did as a pattern for the agricultural year. And this shared culture gave a distinct shape to the calendar and powerfully contributed to national and regional identities. So the calendar has always been a social construction and a political issue to some degree, which is, of course, why it was dismantled by reformist zealots as an example of Catholic idolatry, as well as being extinguished in very different ways by the Georgian middling classes in their pursuit of the ideals of the pastoral and the picturesque and the perfect English garden. The result of these drastic depredations has been increasingly to represent the landscape as a figurative space and less as a literal place. And in doing so, to remove rural labour and culture from the perception of the countryside as an ideological justification for such activities as enclosure, privatisation and commercialisation. And one consequence of this has been that many of the customs within the English festive year that have apparently survived to this day are often comparatively recent, either anti-Puritan revivals dating from the Restoration or Victorian reinventions of the past inspired by guilt about the Enclosure Acts. That might not matter. But even so, little remains of the English festive year to give a cultural meaning to the calendar. And English identity, which itself has been in crisis since the Second World War, has furthermore been increasingly displaced from the management of the land and from agricultural production, from that distinctive cycle of a seasonal year, by modern farming practices and interventionist legislation. This collapse of a cultural calendar is now accelerating, of course, because climate change is significantly altering the weather. Now, for a striking example of how the culture of the festive year conflicts with the current climate and how it's been resolved by political economy, consider not the lilies of the field, but the daffodils of the Lake District. Or rather, Wordsworth's poem on daffodils, first published in 1807. I wandered lonely as a cloud that floats on high o'er vales and hills, when all at once I saw a crowd, a host of golden daffodils, beside the lake, beneath the trees, 10,000 dancing in the breeze. These verses have inspired not only poets, but tea towels, fridge magnets, t-shirts, rappers, and horticulturalists everywhere. And the Lake District National Park, itself a protected space created in part by Wordsworth's own campaigning, is traditionally where lovers of Wordsworth's poetry go to gaze upon golden daffodils in the springtime. In 2007, the flowers bloomed early. Due to late frosts, they were not expected to last until Easter. But so as not to disappoint visitors to Fulborough Park on the shores of Lake Windermere, 100 silk and plastic daffodils were planted in their place. Caroline Griffith, marketing manager of South Lakeland Park, said, "Our guests love to see the daffodils in bloom when they come for their Easter break, but this year the flowers have been out since the middle of February. We've ordered 100 of the artificial flowers and already planted quite a few of them. They look realistic, and none of our visitors, or the ducks and swans, have noticed the difference." Now, the plastic daffodils haven't become a regular feature yet. But this isn't all. In 2012, the village of Burton-on-the-Water, known as the Venice of the Cotswolds, and voted among England's prettiest villages, replaced a patch of grass in the village along the River Windrush with AstroTurf. It's still there today, I checked a couple of days ago. I phoned up the Tourist Information Bureau. And interestingly, this village has also trialled silk flowers in hanging baskets. So, is the English springtime of the future going to be one of plastic flowers, pre-recorded cuckoos, and fake April showers? A virtual reality engineered by the soft cultural clichés and driven by the market forces of heritage tourism. Well, we'll have to see. The English pastoral tradition is strongly evident, of course, in the work of the major English poets before the 18th century. Chaucer, Spenser, Milton, Shakespeare, Dryden of this parish, of course. And it also influenced later writers, such as Pope. It derived, like so much thinking of the period, from the huge intellectual enthusiasm for the ancient classical world that pervaded the Middle Ages and dominated the Renaissance. Roman literature in general, in fact Virgil in particular, was held to be the apex of poetry and profoundly influenced English writers. This meant that literary accounts of English landscapes and farming during the period were based on Roman environmental and agricultural descriptions recorded some 1,500 years earlier. So it's a conscious attempt to Latinise England, to unite it across the ages with the glory of Rome. What this means in practice, though, was that the English countryside was being celebrated in the ways that made it conform to the cultural standards of a different epoch and another country. There were a few exceptions, I think Shakespeare in particular, his fascination with indigenous weather, for example. But in the main, and for centuries, and this is happening at the level of folklore as well with the proverbs about weather, such as St. Swithin's Day, for example, English pastoral writing and pastoral traditions were a gigantic exercise in imitation that eventually had deleterious effects on the countryside. Pastoral poets, in particular, imitated the ancients. The English landscape disappeared under a classical veneer, and these cultural expectations significantly affected subsequent attempts to make sense of rural life and the environment. Now, I think that the Song of the Nightingale affords an example here. Coleridge's conversation poem, The Nightingale, with which you may well be familiar, is a poem that tries to resist the cultural reputation of the nightingale and just listen to the bird's song. But it proves impossible for the poet to achieve this. The nightingale is more a bird of culture than a creature of the trees, just as the trees themselves form cultural or textural woods. And hark, Coleridge writes, the nightingale begins its song, most musical, most melancholy bird. A melancholy bird, oh, idle thought, in nature there is nothing melancholy. Now, Coleridge goes on to criticise this excessive mannered craft of versifying. Poet who hath been building up the rhyme when he had better far have stretched his limbs beside a brook in mossy forest dell. In other words, poets need to get out more. Is the nightingale metaphorical or literal? Its main association, of course, is described by Ovid in Metamorphoses, and is alluded to by Coleridge when he mentions Philomela. Philomela was the sister of Procne, who was married to Tereus, the king of Thrace. Tereus raped Philomela and then cut out her tongue to prevent her confessing against him. Philomela, however, communicated the story of the crime to her sister in a tapestry, and they revenged themselves against Tereus by murdering his son Itys, baking him in a pie and feeding him to his father. When this ghastly secret is revealed, reality collapses and Tereus is transformed into a hoopoe, Procne into a swallow, and Philomela into the nightingale. Well, Coleridge's bird is specifically not Philomela, he says. "'Twill not be so." He explicitly refuses the association and yet simultaneously and indelibly confirms it. But how far can Coleridge's nightingale be considered a real bird, and how can its voice be represented? Perhaps more to the point, could Coleridge himself actually recognise the nightingale? Coleridge does describe the song, but loosely. For him, it is a fast, thick warble, a love chant, murmurs, musical and swift, jug jug, choral minstrelsy, wanton song. Now, John Clare, of course, was hugely amused when he visited London and saw a group of metropolitan types listening with rapt attention to what they thought was a nightingale, but which Clare knew was actually a blackbird. Does this matter? Why does this matter? Can we judge the bird song without the cultural references, or appreciate cultural references having forgotten or never heard the song? Do we experience the song first and then read the poetry? Well, perhaps if we're John Clare, we do. But I think that for most of us, there are a series of more complicated interactions in which we come across cultural and social references to nightingales, say, far more frequently than we hear the bird's song itself. And when finally we do hear it, we may find that our cultural expectations are so high that we're somehow disappointed in the natural experience. Nature fails to live up to culture. The bird is better off staying in a poem rather than roosting in the woods, perhaps. Now, these issues get to the core, I think, of pragmatist ways of reading poetry, ways of reading that emphasise embodied and situated experience in order to stress the consequences of these for future experience. While we should be aware that nightingales are real birds with songs that can still be heard today, just as daffodils, believe it or not, are real flowers, our experience of them is profoundly cultural, often when we think with being most natural. Pragmatism in literary criticism could therefore be considered as a pursuit of a better integration of art and life, a way of understanding that culture and nature are mutually dependent. And doing so might enable us to understand not only culture better, but also the environment. And that's why I think that this pragmatist critique could best be described as cultural environmentalism, to distinguish it from what's been called eco-criticism. Now, I'd now like to play you a recording of a nightingale, but then we'll then see whether Clare himself captures its song. In fact, I was going to play you a recording of a blackbird to see whether anybody knows that. I'm sure sort of half the people in this room would probably be able to tell the difference, so I won't speak to the other half. This is quite an interesting recording made during the Second World War. There are Lancaster and Wellington bombers in the background. So this is the text, if you like, that combines the natural and the political. So just listen to the song. That's the song of the nightingale. Now, this song has already been described at length by Pliny in his Natural History. This is the 1601 translation. I'm not going to go through that. More interestingly, I think, is George Gascoigne's account in his poem The Complaints of Philony, and he explains its song. Tirou, tirou, and thus she began to plain, most piteously, which made my heart to grieve. Her second note was 5-5-5-5-5, drug, 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 in grief. But one strange note I noted with the rest, and that said thus, nemesis, nemesis. Now, that last line, last stanza, its call of nemesis, nemesis, may alert us. Gascoigne goes on to say, her foremost note, tirou, tirou, doth sing, complaining still upon the name of that false Thracian king. So Tirou is Tereus. Her second note is Phi, the exclamation Phi. The next note to her Phi, says Gascoigne, is jug, 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 I guess. Some think that jugum is the jug, she juggleth so, but jugulator is the word that doubleth all her woe. The Latin jugum signifies literally a yoke, a pair, or the bond of matrimony, as broken by Tereus in the myth. Jugulator is one who slashes the throat, and so cutting out Philomela's tongue is metonymically close enough to having the throat slit. And of course, Nemesis is the goddess of retribution. So I just want to offer that now as a context for Clare's own transcription of the Song of the Nightingale in the progress of rhyme. I'm quite tempted to ask somebody to read this out, but I think I'll read it myself. So this is what Clare writes. The nightingale sounds choo-choo, choo-choo, cheer-cheer, cheer-cheer, cheer-up, 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 then low. Tweet-tweet-tweet, jug-jug-jug, woo-woo, woo-woo, chur-chur-chur-chur, tiroo, 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 will-will, will-will, grig-grig-grig-grig, then jug-jug-jug, and all was still. Now, Clare's apparently objective recording of the Song of the Nightingale is, I suggest, already based on a cultural representation of it. The final jug, jug, jug is a literary convention derived from the classical myth, jugulator, executed. So evidently it's hard, even for a peasant poet, to listen to nature without cultural models of the world framing it. And indeed, one could read other phrases in his transcription as referring to the metamorphosis of Philomela. Tirou, 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 tirou would be tirou, Tereus, and even possibly the wry cheer up, cheer up, cheer up. Indeed, in Clare's later poem, The March Nightingale, he explicitly poeticizes the bird, again, by placing the very conventionalized bird song within quotation marks. He writes, sweet, jug, 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 comes loud upon his ear. But my aim here is not to expose Clare's inadvertent cultural debt any more than it is to undermine Coleridge's desire not to sentimentalise nature by suggesting that it's the very thing that he does himself. I'm certainly not suggesting that Clare was directly familiar with the work of George Gascoigne. But rather, the point of a pragmatist understanding of such poems is that the goal of knowledge is not to copy existing reality, but to transform it to provide a better experience. So consequently, Coleridge's Nightingale can be read as a warning against simplistic ways of applying culture to nature and a plea for a more topical, personal, and courageous engagement. Ultimately, his poem is about our environmental responsibilities to the next generation. The child in that poem must one day learn how to survive the night without his parents and with only the sounds of the birds for guidance. Let us hope, of course, that they'll still be there and will continue to be singing. Claire's poem, too, speaks of the entangled relationship between culture and nature, the inextricability of one from the other. The environment is already a cultural site. Now, both Coleridge and Claire were also responding to the seasons. James Thompson's great poem, series of poems, first published in 1729-30, and the most popular book of poetry in the 18th century. The seasons described, or properly actually constituted, the educated person's perception of the English countryside at the time. According to Joseph Warton, for example, the seasons had not only introduced its readers to the beauties of the indigenous English landscape, hitherto frequently overlooked or perceived primarily in terms of the profitability of natural sources, it had actually inspired its readers to follow in Thompson's footsteps and visit the places or the sorts of places mentioned in the poem. Warton writes, "The seasons of Thompson have been very instrumental in diffusing a general taste for the beauties of nature and landscape. It is only within a few years that the picturesque scenes of our own country, our lakes, mountains, cascades, caverns and castles have been visited and described." So this is the beginning of local tourism and the cult of the picturesque. And arguably today's visitors to Fulborough Park are the children of Thompson's seasons. Now Coleridge himself was acutely aware of Thompson's impact. In 1798 he found a copy of the seasons left in a country hostelry for the benefit of visitors to the area. This was precisely the ambition for connecting literature with people and places that he and Wordsworth had aimed at in Lyrical Ballads, published in the same year. Coleridge exclaimed, "That is true fame." And in fact, Wordsworth subsequently wrote admiringly about Thompson in later editions of Lyrical Ballads. Claire, meanwhile, described the discovery of Thompson's seasons as one of the great literary moments of my life. And Thompson was also acclaimed by the painters Turner and Constable. Lines from Summer, for example, were used as epigraphs by both painters. Two generations after the Civil War, then, Thompson was reinventing the English pastoral for an 18th century British readership. Many elements of the classical and earlier English pastoral were retained. Thompson admitted that he was indebted to Virgil. He personified the seasons, treated them as muses. He included stock figures such as a shepherd, a mower, and a swain sleeping in the sun. There's even a flute heard and a lovelorn youth wandering with a picaresque abandon. National identity was also writ large in Thompson's scheme. He focused on wealth, commerce, patriotism, the empire and the navy, and the progress of recent political history. As John Aitken argued later in the century, a taste for nature is said to be equivalent to a love of liberty and truth. James Thompson, lest it be forgot, not only wrote the political poem Liberty, but also the imperial anthem Rule Britannia. There's also much indigenous detail in Thompson's poems. Spring has snowdrops, crocuses, daisies, primrose and violets. It's got plovers and bitterns calling. Indeed, spring is like a walk through the countryside. It unfolds or opens like the pages of a book, and summer describes one perfect day in the summer season. So this is virtual tourism now, desperately trying to present the impression of being there. Now, Samuel Johnson criticised what he called these circumstantial varieties. For all of its structure, seasonal structure, he said that the poem lacked any real unity because Thompson's overridingly visual technique of minute observation creates chaos. There's abundance and superfluity. There's too much of everything all of the time. If you read the seasons, it can be a bewildering experience. And he also models systems upon systems, preeminent of which is Newtonian science. And so Thompson takes his account of the rainbow, not from his own observation of the rainbow, or from the folklore of the rainbow, but from Newton's account of a prism in his book Optics, untwisting to the philosophic eye, writes Thompson, the various twine of light. Well, that's, of course, just what you think about when you see
a rainbow. Wordsworth, however, praised Thomson, and his great autobiographical work, The Prelude, was suffused with Thomson's Seasons. But according to his sister Dorothy, William was ever haunted with altering the rainbow. The poet should not merely scientifically observe, as did Thomson, but yearned, Dorothy wrote, to be out of doors and see and feel the beauty of the autumn in freedom. The Romantics also recognised in Thomson's Seasons the sensibility of leisure, the tendency to treat the countryside either as a huge middle-class park for outings or as the occasion for anthems celebrating trade, colonial expansion and the national interest. None of this sympathised with the plight of the labouring classes, but then they're as good as absent from this poem in any case. So a more sinister way of describing the state of affairs, the state of affairs in the most popular poem of the century, would be to indicate how few agricultural labourers there are at all in Thomson's poem, how little rustic culture is described, and how scant the festive traditions are. What is perhaps most striking about Thomson's Seasons in the context of the English seasons is how little he takes from the traditional calendar. The more Thomson tried to link his cycles of experience to the new science, the more he disconnected from the pastoral, from weather lore, local customs, festivities, the whole culture of time and change, not to mention the working year itself. There's little folklore, no mention of saints' days, despite the still solid framework of that traditional year. For all the accumulation of new scientific and perceptual detail, there's virtually nothing on farming, unless it's to make a passing point about increased yields due to new agricultural techniques. In other words, The Seasons is a poem that attempts to remove the rural people from the countryside. And this, it succeeded. Agricultural labourers and their communities were made to disappear from the way that England was being imagined. The Seasons, Thomson's Seasons, presents a vision of England devoid of its agrarian workforce. Within two or three generations, that vision was realised by the Enclosure Acts, which physically removed these people from the homesteads and communities that had supported them for centuries. And with them, sometimes happily, more often reluctantly, but with them went 1,000 years of folk culture. From at least the 16th century then, the image of the English countryside had been made to conform to classical pastoral traditions, and poetry, I'm arguing, was an active agent in this misrepresentation. Indeed, the literary critic James Turner has remarked of 17th century poetry that there's virtually no mention of land clearance, tree felling, pruning, chopping, digging, hoeing, weeding, branding, gelding, slaughtering, salting, tanning, brewing, boiling, smelting, forging, milling, thatching, fencing and hurdle making, hedging, road mending and hawking. Almost everything, he says, which anybody actually does in the countryside is taboo in poetry. And so, of course, neither is there much of that sort of work done on the land in Thomson's poetry. To be able to wander lonely as a cloud, in other words, is not to be in a working landscape, but to be in a deserted landscape, a countryside denuded by enclosure. The 18th century, 19th century cult of the picturesque went hand in hand with this Thomsonian vision. The subtitle of Dale Price's Essays on the Picturesque, published in 1810, should leave the reader in no doubt of its aims. The subtitle is On the Use of Studying Pictures for the Purpose of Improving Real Landscape. More specific, can you? Price unites the picturesque to the sublime in order to develop a manifesto for reworking the English countryside, making the picturesque effectively the militant wing of the pastoral and active agent of the sublime. Although, like the pastoral, the primary objective of the picturesque seems to be concerned with art and beauty, this aestheticism is really another strategy to smuggle a political, social and economic agenda into the management of the countryside. The picturesque and the pastoral, therefore, share the ambition to replace the natural environment with a cultural experience that in turn promotes the economic interests of a particular group. Then it was landowners rather than labourers. Today it might be supermarkets or chains or agribusiness rather than independent retailers or small farmers. The great model for this transformation of nature into culture was the 17th century painter Claude Lorrain, frequently invoked by his besotted acolyte Price. Indeed, for those who lack the imagination, and I'm sure some of you know this, or the patience of a Claude Lorrain, there was even a convenient alternative. This shortcut to the picturesque was the Claude glass, a tinted convex mirror that enhanced the colours and drew all the elements of a scene together into a nice two-dimensional composition. Detail was lost, but harmony appeared to be enhanced. Now, picturesque travellers carried their Claude glasses on their expeditions, either using them as the basis for landscape studies or simply to record mental snapshots of a scene. They were favourite spots for Claude glass viewing, and at least one example of an overambitious enthusiast toppling from a precipice in an attempt to improve his view of the landscape. By means of the Claude glass, then, the picturesque traveller could build a memory library of artistic versions of nature. The only downside was that in order to capture a scene in the black glass, it had to be reflected, which meant that a spectator had to turn his or her back on the real view. There was, in other words, a straight choice here between nature or the kitsch art of the Claude glass. Most picturesque travellers chose what they thought was art. And such picturesque artfulness was deployed in other ways as well. The colours of spring, for instance, were not considered at all suitable for illustrations. The flowers were too gaudy and too frantically busy. So Price recommended painting spring flowers in the more sombre tones of autumn, a little more mature and more restrained. Now, within a century, this deliberate horticultural anachronism, going against nature, was recognised as the height of the art for art's sake movement. Oscar Wilde's Picture of Dorian Gray, 1891, opens with an impossible garden of flowers that bloom deliberately out of season in order to show that we are in the realm of the imagination. The road of the picturesque, in other words, leads to the palace of decadence. Before it arrives at decadence, however, the picturesque was, like the pastoral, enlisted to justify the devastating effects of enclosure. The picturesque was not so much an expression of nostalgia for old, pre-agrarian and pre-industrial revolution country life, as it was an exoneration of the forces of agricultural change that were pauperising hundreds of thousands of rural labourers. Predictably, picturesque views did not include scenes of poverty or, as I've suggested, labour. There were no working farms or agricultural fairs, little or no livestock. William Gilpin, for example, in Observations Relative Chiefly to Picturesque Beauty, 1786, famously stipulated the ideal number of cows in a picturesque view. Two will hardly combine. Three makes a good group. Neither united, or when one is a little removed from the other two. It's the same principle applied to cattle which we before applied to mountains and other objects. So cattle and mountains were just so much rustic detail. And of course the ideal number of rural labourers was none. Now Gilpin certainly knew that the countryside was full of people going about their business, but they had no place in picturesque art. In grand scenes, he writes, even the peasant cannot be admitted if he be employed in a low occupation of his profession. The spade, the scythe, and the rake are all excluded. What was allowed was pastoral idleness. He's quite happy to have the lazy cowherd resting on his pole, or the peasant lolling on a rock. An angler rather than a fisherman, gypsies, banditti, the occasional individual soldier in antique armour. So the image of the countryside presented, therefore, looked very much in need of improvement. It was slack, inefficient, indigent, lawless, and archaic. And, of course, once improved, the landscape was likely to be as empty of agricultural labour as a picturesque depicted it, as nearly all the peasantry would have been forced off to land. William Mason was quite explicit on this point. He wrote, "As we have all along considered the garden as a picture, so we are under the necessity of considering the unadorned and naked soil as the painter's canvas, and consequently of looking on every means of ornament as the pencils and colours with which he is to work, the artist to work. So trees and streams were consequently merely ways of tinting the composition. They were not, said Mason, essential to the existence of the scene, which may subsist without them. It may subsist without streams and trees. So Mason advocates that nature be understood not as a seasonal cycle of growth and decay, of budding and harvest, of sustainability and diversity through, for example, the protection and cultivation of properly irrigated woodlands, but that the moral, intellectual and cultural value of these natural spaces resides solely in their conformity to the picturesque. So it is, of course, again, the equivalent of planting plastic daffodils at Easter in the Lake District. Mason is sort of the laureate of this brave new world of environmental hygiene, but he's not alone. Criticising Richard Payne Knight's poem, The Landscape, a response to Mason's English Garden, Humphrey Repton remarked with unconcealed contempt that the enthusiasm for picturesque detail seems to have so completely bewildered the author of The Landscape, a poem, that he not only mistakes the essential difference between the landscape painter and the landscape gardener, but appears even to forget that a dwelling house is an object of comfort and convenience for the purpose of habitation, and not merely the frame to a landscape or the foreground of a rural picture. So Repton certainly recognised the dangers in sentimentalising tumble-down country cottages as picturesque. Such tendencies risked denying the inhabitants the advantages of safe new housing, allowing them the properly tended gardens in which they could grow their own vegetables, perhaps, and also enjoy some dignity. But Mason even attacked cottagers who presumed to mow their own lawns, as this could compromise the picturesque qualities of a scene. He says, "Break their fell scythes that would these beauties shave, and sink their iron rollers in the wave." To the pastoral and the picturesque, the acculturations of the environment, with devastating consequences, reveal the politics, I think, of cultural environmentalism, suggest how it may be enlisted in assessing the influence and indeed the value of literature. By taking the reality of rural life and sustainable communities out of the landscape, the pastoral and the picturesque underwrote the forces of political economy and the interests of landowners. The challenge, I think, now is to put these realities back in the interests of ecological conservation and environmental sustainability. Literature and painting reinvented the English countryside over hundreds of years. Today, we should be seeking to represent the environment in ways that resist the pastoral and the picturesque, that value local identities and indigenous cultures, and write identity, heritage, and history back into the land. And that could be the basis of an environmental criticism. Now, it's evident, of course, throughout the work of John Clare, most obviously in his writings on nature, but also in his sense of community. Clare repeatedly dwells on cultural memory and the meaning that humanity brings to the environment. On the 25th of October, 1824, for instance, he recorded that old Shepherd Newman died this morning, an old tenant of the fields and the last of the old shepherds. The fields are now left desolate, and his old haunts look like houses disinhabited. The fading woods seem mourning in the autumn wind. How often hath he seen the blue sky, the green fields and woods, and the seasons changes, and now he sleeps unconscious of all. What a desolate mystery doth it leave round the living mind. Landscapes are not just physical spaces, but layer upon layer of personal, local and religious and regional identity. And while it's clear that not everything can be preserved, the secret is surely to remind ourselves of how we can dwell in a place and involve ourselves with it, both socially and practically. In contrast to Thompson and his school, then, Clare reveals in his poetry the richness of rural cultural heritage. In A Shepherd's Calendar, published in 1827, there's a wealth of seasonal detail, I'm being particularly seasonal by giving you the handout of Christmas this evening. These verses are particularly rich. Evergreens, such as holly, yew, box and ivy, decorate the cottages, and the country folk exchange seasonal greetings. Glad Christmas and a happy year. Lovers kiss beneath mistletoe. Carols are sung and bells rung. Morris dances and mummers' plays are performed. Donations placed in Christmas boxes. Geese are plucked. Cake is handed around. Candles are lit. And old stories told around the ash faggot fire. Typically, Clare focuses on the wonder of children. while children tween their parents' knees sing scraps of carols by heart. So I find that very moving, because my own children now have been doing that over the past few days. Children watch the snow flurries and slide on ice. They play with their presents and inevitably break a few of them. Now this is a striking record of pre-Victorian seasonal culture. There are no Christmas trees, of course. Although these had been introduced by the Hanoverians, they were not popularised until the Illustrated London News in 1848 pictured Victoria and Albert at home with a decorated tree. Neither are there cards or crackers, which also both emerged in the 1840s. But there's nevertheless much else. The practice of decorating interiors with evergreen foliage had been permitted by the Church of England from the 7th century. For hundreds of years, these seasonal adornments only went up on Christmas Eve, never beforehand, and stayed up until Candlemas Eve, the 1st of February. In 1598, John Snow recorded in London that against the feast of Christmas, every man's house, as also their parish churches, were decked with home, ivy, bays, and whatsoever the season of the year afforded to be green. The conduits and standards in the streets were likewise garnished. Mistletoe emerged in the mid-17th century as a popular ornamental wild plant, although it was deemed unlucky in some places. Robert Herrick, in Ceremonies to Christmas Eve in Hesperides, 1648, for instance, recalls mistletoe on display, but advises taking it down on Christmas Day itself. The anonymous pamphlet Roundabout Our Cold Fire, 1730, describes interiors embowered with holly, ivy, cypress, bays, laurel and mistletoe, and a bouncing Christmas log in the chimney glowing like the cheeks of a country milkmaid. Kissing games are alluded to in a 14th century poem, Sir Gawain and the Green Knight, but kissing specifically under the mistletoe is first recorded by the visiting American writer Washington Irving in his sketchbook of 1819 and 1820. So Claire's, you know, referring to something much more recent, perhaps. Burning the Yule log, or the ashen faggot, is also mentioned by Herrick, the custom being to light the new fire with the charred remains of last year's log, which were preserved as charms against fire and lightning, the house being struck by lightning. But shortly before the publication of Clare's poem, Thomas Dudley Fosbrooke noticed that on Christmas Eve, candles of uncommon size, called Christmas candles, were lit up, and a log of wood, called a Yule clog, or Christmas block, was laid upon the fire to illuminate the house and, as it were, turn night into day. At Taunton in Somerset in the 18th and 19th centuries, the custom of the Yule log was gentrified in the form of the ashen faggot ball, the ashen faggot being a local version of the Christmas log in the form of ash tree sticks bound tightly together. Of course, Claire is alluding to that. And in today's centrally heated homes, the Yule log has been replaced by a chocolate log with red candles to signify the flames. Church bells rang and doors opened to welcome Christmas in. And the toast and salutation, "I pray God send you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year," seems to date from the late 17th century. Carols are described again in Gawain and the Green Knight, although carols here refer to dances. But singing carols does have medieval origins. Caroling continued throughout the 12 days of Christmas, and the tradition was so strong and the repertoire so extensive that it survived the Commonwealth, the Cromwellian Commonwealth, which prohibited the celebration of Christmas because there's no biblical authority for the festival. In 1657, the diarist John Evelyn was arrested at gunpoint in church on Christmas Day for celebrating the Nativity. Christmas waits, mummers' plays and hobby horses, as well as Morris dancing, still continue in parts of the country today. The Kent mummers retain the Hoden horse. In Derbyshire, there's Old Horse, as well as Old Tup, and of course the Derby Ram. Mumming was, however, in part superseded by pantomimes, first performed as classical pastiches in England in 1717 and drawing on both the European harlequinade tradition and native mummers plays, as Claire again suggests here. The practice of making a winter cash donation to servants on St. Stephen's Day, that's why it's called Boxing Day, goes back at least to the beginning of the 18th century and may have originated in the 1620s, with apprentices and servants collecting tips. In the 19th century, according to the footman diarist William Taylor, gangs of sweeps, beadles, lamplighters, watermen, dustmen, scavengers, that's the men who clean the mud out on the streets, newspaper boys, general postmen, tuppenny postmen and waits would roam the streets playing music and expecting monetary handouts for their trouble. Children also went speculatively begging on this day, a practice known as stevening, as they did on various other days, such as on All Hallows. Charity is also evident more generally in the convivial Christmas customs of the Restoration, in which the hierarchy of socialising was in inverse proportion to one's station. In other words, the gentry dined the poor first, and guests increased in social rank throughout the days of Christmas, until eventually the lord and lady of the manor were dining with their equals. This itself was a genial version of the older Lord of Misrule tradition. John Stowe records how large households appointed a master of ceremonies to preside over festivities from All Hallows, that's the 1st of November, all the way through to Candlemas, 2nd of February. This was the master of merry disporters. He organised games and parties, engaged performers, played pranks and generally cut capers about the place, more for pastime than for gain. These practices continued throughout the 18th century. Dancing, singing, masquerading and closet dramas were popular, as were games such as Blind Man's Buff, Puss in the Corner, which is a kissing game, I've never played it actually, Questions and Commands, a Truth or Dare game, which I have played, Hide and Hoop, which is Hide and Seek, and Gambling with Cards and Dice. The French commentator Henri Misson noted in 1698 that exchanging gifts and providing little treats was not so much a social custom observed from friend to friend as from equal to equal, from friend to friend or from equal to equal, as from superior to inferior or from host to guest. He explained, in the taverns, the landlord gives a part of what is eaten and drunk in his house on Christmas Day in the next 2 days, and they reckon you for the wine, but they tell you there's nothing to pay for bread or for your slice of bacon or ham. You should still sometimes get that in pubs if you go in on Christmas Day, if you been drinking for the other 364 days of the year. Despite Dickens's later emphasis on the Christmas goose, Boar's Head was the Christmas dinner par excellence. But until the 19th century, most who could afford it dined on roast beef. Turkey was first imported from the New World in about 1530, and from the mid-16th century was being reared in England. Initially it appeared to those with exotic tastes, but by the 18th century was considered traditional by commentators such as the poet and playwright John Gay. Goose was traditionally consumed at Michaelmas, that's the 29th of September. At Christmas it was only for the poor if they could find any birds that had survived Michaelmas. Until the 19th century, minced pies had real meat in them. They were oblong and known as coffins, and eating them was actually supposed to be lucky for the forthcoming year. Until the end of the 15th century, plum pottage or porridge also contained meat. Thereafter it contained suet. Rich and lavish fare was therefore the watchword. Joseph Dorman noted in 1740, beef, pudding, plum porridge and mince pies in abundance. All around the coal fire notes, sirloins of beef, mince pies, plum porridge, capons, turkeys, geese and plum puddings. They're all consumed in quantity. And drinking was popular too. From at least 1300, to keep wassail was the social custom of drinking the health of the assembled company. Communal wassail bowls began and ended the season, and seasonal drinks such as lamb's wool, which was hot ale, spices, sugar, roasted apples, and possibly eggs and cream, were shared from Christmas Eve until Twelfth Night, and also later wassailing customs when fruit trees were woken up by being sprinkled with ale, having toast hung in their branches and shots fired over them, songs sung around them. The wassail was cut was drank there as well. Christmas cake is perhaps the oldest English Christmas tradition, alluded to by the venerable Bede. It was usually eaten on Twelfth Night. So such traditions therefore bound communities together by spreading good cheer. Clare also mentions the custom of telling winter tales or ghost stories, a practice mentioned by both Christopher Marlowe and William Shakespeare, and specifically described in 1730 as recalling the curious memoirs of Old Father Christmas. Now, Old Father Christmas himself appears in the first lines of Clare's verse. Christmas is come, and every hearth makes room to give him welcome now. He's crowned with holly and tramped through the snow. There's no red-nosed reindeers for Old Father Christmas. He has his origins in the Lords of Misrule, and a Sir Christmas is mentioned in a carol from about 1500. He was later enlisted as a defender of royalist festive values against the repressive Commonwealth of the Puritans. So old Father Christmas was a carnivalesque figure, bedecked with holly, usually dressed in green to harmonise with winter decorations, or white for snow, or even a jolly shade of blue. It was only after 1862 that the Dutch-American figure of Santa Claus began to appear in a red coat trimmed with white fur. So Clare's verses, December Christmas, are, as one would expect, underpinned by Clare's keen eye for detail in the social practices that make up the customary Christmas. The poem bears witness to these and records them in an act of preservation. These practices are cohesive. They forge and sustain community identity by anchoring it to tradition, both archaic and recent customs. What the poem enacts, in other words, is cultural formation, a cultural formation of shared immaterial activities. So what I'm trying to suggest here is a connection between the acculturation of birdsong identified by Clare and the intangible cultural heritage in which he engages us at Christmas time. We vicariously participate in this heritage, not only as readers of this particular poem, but precisely at this time of the year, if we might sing carols or kiss under the mistletoe. Now, my point is then, is that we're participating in very different sorts of discourses if our involvement is merely at the level of spectating. If Christmas, for example, is spent watching unmissable celebrity specials on the widescreen telly. There's just been that one with Michael Burke, hasn't there? I used to have integrity, get me out of here. The default position of heritage is to highlight material culture. We live in a world of stuff. There's stuff everywhere, palpable, solid objects. Our lives are mediated through material things, personal possessions, private property, houses full of knick-knacks, the ubiquitous portable gadgetry of smartphones, iPads. Likewise, our museums are built environments full of physical, often untouchable, artifacts. Things are the stuff of life, and so heritage usually means the specifically tangible heritage, what can be seen and felt, restored and displayed, archaeologically excavated or forensically analysed. Material culture, whether the Mary Rose or the Alfred Jewel, is sovereign. So consequently, heritage tends to be seen in quantifiable monetary terms. Buildings, paintings, artefacts and archives are investments. They're purchased and insured. They're assessed through funding bids and footfall. To the extent that in 2013, heritage tourism was worth some £26.4 billion to the UK economy. But this sort of economic appraisal, significant if it undoubtedly is, is the same sort of thinking that evaluates the countryside, for example, by quantifying its productivity through crop yield or grazing capacity or opportunities for housing development or the fracking potential of land. Even air currents and the tides have been harnessed as power generators, supposedly green alternatives to fossil fuels or nuclear energy. Although, rather than computing the harvest from the wind and wave farms that erode landscapes and seascapes in their own insensitive ways, the real solution to the energy crisis and to carbon emissions and their contribution to greenhouse effect may simply be to consume less. Now, I don't believe that heritage and cultural conservation are independent of these ecological issues. Rather, as I've been suggesting, culture should be at the heart of environmental thinking. Heritage and culture can alert us to the non-quantifiable, the qualitative elements of a place or of a building in need of conservation or of a whole locale or region. Let's think what is left out when an acre of land is seen simply in terms of profit. What's missing when urban development is based on the arithmetic of providing housing rather than homes? Aesthetic qualities might be nigh on impossible to define or even quantify, but they're nevertheless deep influences on why many people visit or live in the countryside. The engagement with the natural world and green spaces stimulates well-being, restores a sense of identity and even spiritual connections in relation to the rhythms and seasons of the natural world. The aesthetics of the land can also alert us to the distinctiveness of certain locations and communities, their own particular traditions, customs and heritages, situating and educating us in the complexity and changeability and uniqueness of different places. Now, such indefinable and intangible elements saturate the environments and communities in which we dwell, and yet they usually go unnoticed. So an agenda needs to be developed to ensure that welfare, security, health and social cohesion are recognised as forming a fundamental part, the most human part, of any assessment of a site or location. We need to build and sustain resilient communities and develop support mechanisms that can reconnect these communities to their own individual heritage and also to the wider national life. On the 17th of November 2003, UNESCO declared its Convention for the Safeguarding of the Intangible Cultural Heritage. Their definition of intangible heritage covers customs and traditions, often highly localised and distinctive, what they call the practices, representations, expressions, memories, knowledge and skills that communities, groups and individuals construct, use and transmit from generation to generation. In practical terms, this means engaging with the specific needs and aspirations of a place or community by supporting the cultural activities and practices that give meaning to everyday life there. And this often means those small communities that are so easily overlooked by policymakers and funding bodies. And the challenge then is not to default to preserving material culture, but to conserve the immaterial, the stuff that people actually do. The key challenge, I suggest, as we look to the future, is to decide not only what the world will look like for the next generation, but also, crucially, how it will be lived. And this is what we can learn from John Clare at Christmas. We need to shift our attention to unquantifiable, qualitative values, to the intangible and the immaterial, and find ways of preserving and promoting such cultural diversity and distinctiveness. If we can manage to do so, and thereby sustain local communities and foster identity, we will, I believe, have made a priceless bequest. Merry Christmas.
Well, thank you very much indeed, Nick, for that, for making the intangible tangible, and for convincing us that you are a true nightingale, not a blackbird. We just have chance for a question or two.
Nick, your idea, you associate the Father Christmas figure with the Lord of Misrule. And I just wondered if you felt that there was any link to Saturnalia with that. The general idea of, I mean, it all gets mixed up with Epiphany a bit later on, but I want you to give your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right there. I mean, there are various people who've written about this, including Ronald Hutton, for example, and yes. I think that sort of classical inheritance can be seen through the Lord of Misrule figure. I mean, and I think that it's probably more conscious than I'm suggesting that it is. In other words, it's another example of that deliberate connection with that particular past. What I'm sort of suspicious about is that these things have somehow survived underground have been sort of being practiced for generations and generations, unrecorded, and then sort of suddenly noticed by a folklorist. I think that they tend to be much more conscious and sort of deliberate references being made as ways of establishing identity. They are sort of identity-forming moments. I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, I think one of the things I tried to sort of point out in the season's book is that, yeah, some traditions might go back centuries, some go back decades, some probably go back only, you know, last year. The point is that people do them, and therefore it's that active engagement with identity forming, with the world that's important, rather than whether something has been going on, you know, for generations and generations, and has that, you know. In other words, I'm suspicious of that as an authenticating device for a particular practice. But certainly, I mean, I think sort of, I mean, I've been increasingly interested in Old Father Christmas, not just because Christmas is about to be upon us, but
the shift from a developing figure that sort of Claire is clearly alluding to, that within a few years had been totally eclipsed by the Santa Claus figure of the Night Before Christmas poem, that has this sort of overwhelming popularity, and sort of sets up an alternative St. Nicholas figure, which is then adapted mainly through Dutch American commercialization until we get Coca-Cola getting on board in the 1930s, and you know, we end up with the figure that we've got today. So I think there's room to think about what that eclipse or what that shift actually means, and how it affects the way that we read sort of the verses such as December Christmas. Really, it's quite difficult, you know, because Father Christmas in the late 20th century form is the way in which that's our reference for reading things. So I find poems like this particularly interesting, the ways of trying to divest those memories and understand what Claire was actually trying to do with something that was inevitably oblivious of what was going to happen in the next 50 or so years. But certainly, I think that, I mean, Claire, of course, is interesting when he's sort of talking about the classical traditions, because although he identifies with them partially through Thompson, of course, he doesn't have that education or that frame of reference to the same degree that others do. And you've also got people like, you know, Ellis and Brand who are writing at this time, who are also deliberately trying to give these figures that sort of classical respectability as well, I think. So a lot of it's in the air, definitely. But no, thank you. It was a really, really helpful point. Thanks.
Mary had a question.
Yes, well, returning back sort of to the earlier part of your talk, really, and that here in Northamptonshire, being as far away as possible from any national park or area of outstanding natural beauty, I just kind of feel that we're in the sort of the real landscape. So, and I've often wondered quite what I think about, say, in the Dales, when they maintain all these pretty little stone barns that are actually redundant, but they're kept for the character of the area. Thinking about the authenticity of the landscape that you're looking at, what do you think about things like that?
I think it's such a difficult question because there are so many sort of levels at which one is going to approach this. Of course, there is a lucrative heritage tourist industry, which is one of the reasons why people go to those sorts of national parks. They're obviously important as ecological preservation sites as well. The thing that's, it concerns me is that we need to be aware, if we are sentimentalising the landscape, and we need to think about why we're doing it. You know, why, if we're taking a picture of a landscape, are we waiting for those people in orange cubicles to get out of the way, to give the impression it's just us in this particular landscape? Why is it that Wordsworth, for example, has influenced conservation laws within national parks by saying you can only paint your cottages in a certain colour? So there's a particular agenda that's being pursued there. And so I really just want to raise some level of awareness to sensitise people in terms of, you know, are we admiring this for aesthetic reasons? And in that case, where are those aesthetic values coming from? Or are we thinking about them in other ways? And where are those particular values coming from? But I live in an old cottage out in the National Park, so in a sense I'm as bad as everybody else, as Charles said earlier, sort of, it's the Waitrose lifestyle. Although I do try to keep my feet on the ground with some local farming practices and so forth. But no, I think that it's really trying to make people more sensitive, more aware of this. Because Northamptonshire has been absolutely devastated, I mean, within living memory, by agribusiness, particularly in South Northamptonshire, where I grew up, which is these, you know, huge mass farmed sort of arable fields now, which have grubbed out all the hedgerows, had very catastrophic effects, I think, on a lot of the flora and fauna. And yet the hedges were there through enclosure, so they don't go back that far. But that's one of the things, you know, people think about the patchwork of English fields, what Wordsworth writes about in, you know, Tintin Abbey, for example, was something which, that's about privatisation, it's about, you know, coming up with what we consider to be modern farming practices. And yeah, sure, some people went off the land because they wanted to. I mean, Simon White's written about this. You know, some of them jumped at the chance to set up their businesses in market towns and so forth. But the vast majority were driven off, and communities were broken up, and they'd end up working
as the, you know, the workforce of the Industrial Revolution. So I don't think there's a sort of there's a simple answer. But I think, I mean, what I suppose what I try to do if I'm looking at something which I think is, you know, a tumble down cottage is, you know, what are the sort of processes of this of aesthetic appreciation of this?
There's a question over here, yeah.
So if I'm following that up, the often the ecological value of a landscape doesn't go hand in hand with its aesthetic value. So there are large parts of the Nen Valley, for instance, that have internationally important designation, United Nations level designation for its wildlife, for overwintering birds, for example, on the gravel pits up towards Stoney Place,
yes.
and so on. Yet, as a landscape, it's not particularly attractive. So often the two things don't go.
I think it's really helpful. I think that's something that poets and artists, photographers, filmmakers could be writing more about.
Yeah.
So they're not being bewitched or intoxicated by the earlier pastoral models, but they're thinking much more about re-aestheticising through that sort of ecological intelligence that you're talking about, which is what the Dark Mountain Project is trying to do, what Paul Kingsmill, for example, is trying to do, come up with a new aesthetics. And some of you heard me talk before about Chris Chapman, the photographer, and James Crowden, the poet, who've worked, for example, on the mouth crisis in the southwest. I mean, even a poet like J.H. Prynne, for example, I think is trying to do this by thinking about the contamination, chemical contamination of the environment, and what that actually means for the way in which we sort of perceive it and engage with it. So I think you're absolutely right. I think that, you know, the thing is, it gives the opportunity for poets and artists to be, you know, actively involved in rethinking the landscape, in educating their readers, to talk towards a different sort of ecological sensibility.
I should probably decline my interest. I'm a scientist. I'm School of Science and Technology next door.
Oh, good.
Not in the School of Arts. And my particular interest is in pollinators, wild bees, and so on. You want to see wild bees within Northamptonshire. Don't go out into Poopside.
No, exactly.
Sit on the steps of All Saints Church in the middle of town, and we've shown that there are 60 or 70 species
really,
within 500 metres living there, in the old stone walls, and so on. So wildlife is often in places where you don't.
Yeah, and very often it can be urban. I mean, obviously, we're talking about Clare this evening, and I want to emphasise the rural, but I think that, that's way of thinking about urban and metropolitan ecologies is something which. You know, I wouldn't want this to be just seen as a sort of rurophilic paper. Arts activist groups such as Common Ground have, you know, been very keen to demonstrate that the sorts of ecologically aware, sort of environmentally sensitive projects that they are promoting are as valid within towns and cities as they are.
And you can see this I suppose, Robert Farland and Peregrines in Norwich, and also in the kind of Edgeland book as well, Paul Farley book. So this idea that we have, the thing is, we have a series of Englands cohabitating in parallel, depending on how we're looking at them. We have a kind of museum England, you know, we have the new gravel pit England, which might not look nice, but it's actually fabulous. And those things kind of mesh and cohabit, don't they? And it's the kind of thing R.S. Thomas talked about when he talked about Wales. You know, it's a museum piece, he says. You know, the idea of making Wales all nice. You know. Anyway, one last question. This gentleman right here, sorry.
It's not actually a question, but you may be interested to know, all of you, that John Clare was actually got a mention in the House of Commons. Now, if you read his little essay on politics, that is interesting reading, especially nowadays. But they were having a debate on the environment. And one of our Labour MPs, a certain Barry Sherman, who is MP for Huddersfield North, got up and said, well, if you want to study the environment, you must read John Clare. Later on, Gordon Brown came up to Barry Sherman and says, who's this John Clare? And Barry Sherman quite politely said, I mean, you know what Gordon Brown, looking absolutely down, he said, well, he's descended from an itinerant Scotsman. And at that word, Brown's face lit up. So, and I believe he's had another mention since. So, at least somebody knows about it.
At least people who might be beginning to listen. I mean, the thing is, I mean, yes, I mean, despite the initial enthusiasm for Thompson and Seasons, Clare undoubtedly sort of forged his own poetic voice. And this, I mean, the level of attention to the flora and fauna with which he was familiar with is something which we're all aware of. But I mean, I think that also his interest in community. John Goodrich has written about this recently, of course. Yes. In those. In what we now call the intangible cultural heritage and what people do, it's sort of equally important, I think. And it's, you know, he's a force for thinking about the sustainability and the cohesion of the vast of our future communities.
Yeah, I think in many ways, you know, there's probably, well, possibly more interest in Clare now than there has ever been before, which can't be a bad thing. You know, and I think more people are reading him and thinking about it in more and more engaged and interesting ways than ever before. And for very interesting reasons, you know, why is there a whole thing about new nature writing? Why are we suddenly thinking about ecology? Why is everybody very excited about Edward Thomas alongside John Clare? For all of these reasons, the materialist culture we have throws emphasis on the immaterial culture that we have, actually, which was exactly your point. Well, I'm going to leave it. If you've got a question, we're going to have a little mingle afterwards, I suspect. We're not going to dash off immediately. Can I thank you for coming in? Can I just ask you in conclusion, please fill in an evaluation form. And little clever.